Sounds. Hey, good afternoon and welcome to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. I'm John Pranger.
And I'm Marge Adams.
And I'm Carl Luskin.
Our guest today for a full hour is Dr. Ray Greek, a medical doctor and president of Americans for Medical Advancement based in Los Angeles, California. And we're probably going to open up the lines at the halfway mark if we can figure out the technology and be open line for your questions or comments to Dr. Greek. And this I take from his website. For too long, we have allowed the vital resources that support biomedical research to be squandered by the vested interest groups. People are dying every day from cancer, AIDS, heart disease, adverse drug reactions, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, birth defects, and many more illnesses. It's time we, the people, take control of how our taxes are spent in the field of medical research. Americans for Medical Advancement, of which Dr. Greek is the president and founder, along with his wife, who's a veterinarian, this organization promotes human wellness by exposing the lost opportunities for cures and the life-threatening results of animal-modeled biomedical research. They educate the public, showing how government and charities misspend medical research dollars and place us at grave risk. Animal-modeled biomedical research yields results that can't be safely applied to humans. It diverts research dollars that should be going to proven methods of curing human disease, and they disclose how industry introduces and keeps unhealthy and often deadly products in the marketplace through animal experiments. And we'll talk to Dr. Greek in a few minutes, but first, it's the anniversary of the passing of our friend Lindsay Bickford, and I'd like to dedicate this program to his memory. Lindsay was the best friend anyone could ever want and a great guy to work with, and here's Carl with a few words.
Yes, indeed, we do miss Lindsay Bickford. 2 years ago today, our friend and colleague on Animal Voices, Lindsay Bickford, passed away. When Lindsay was in his 60s, he became a member of Earth Save Toastmasters, where he helped people with leadership and communication skills, and he helped me so much. He felt that there was a message about compassion towards animals and vegetarian life that was not being heard, and as such, this version of Animal Voices came into being some 5 years ago. He was a technician, had a degree in electrical and mechanical engineering, and loved to do interviews on his mini disc, and had mastered the art of making CDs at a time when most people did not even know what a CD was. He was in the control room for us, with love and kindness. Lindsay's legacy of good works lives on in his wife, lives on with this program, and to his wife and three children, we extend gratitude for the sharing of the joy of Lindsay's life. Yes, that's 2 years ago that Lindsay, our wonderful control room and program organizer, passed away. Over to you, John.
Yeah, may he rest in peace. Now that you've cracked my voice, I wonder if I can get on with the show. But anyway, here we go. Dr. Ray Greek is a medical doctor and a physician who is board certified in anesthesiology and subspecialty certified in pain management. He is president of Americans for Medical Advancement, a not-for-profit corporation dedicated to educating the public about the hazards of extrapolating the results of experiments on animals to humans. And he was an instructor at two of the United States' most prestigious medical schools and has published in the medical literature. He has performed animal experiments on animals and research with humans. Along with his wife, who is a veterinarian, he's written three books on the scientific fallacy of attempting to extrapolate the results of animal experiments to humans. Sacred Cows and Golden Geese was published in the year 2000 by Continuum Press and was their first. The foreword was written by Jane Goodall. The second book was Specious Science, published in 2002, and that addressed the issue in a little more scientific depth. And the third book, What Will We Do If We Don't Experiment on Animals, published by Trafford in 2004, examined the research modalities available instead of animals. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Greek.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you, sir, for your time. People think doctors unanimously approve of vivisection. There's several organizations, for example, devoted to the management of degenerative neurological diseases, forming coalitions to promote animal research, and things like the or institutions such as Amyotrophic Lateral Sclerosis Association, Huntington's Disease Society of America, Parkinson's Disease Foundation, United Parkinson's Foundation, among 52 health organizations that signed a statement endorsing animal research. And that statement read in part, "While great strides have been made in the understanding, prevention, and treatment of diseases, there's still much to be learned, and much of that research relies on laboratory animals." So that's 52 signatories. Are they plain lies or misguided thinking? There's no proof, they're just statements. Who are these charities? And it looks like you're really up against it, sir.
Well, if you look at those charities closely, what you'll find is that they and other groups that promote the use of animals in biomedical research are either headed by or their board is influenced by the people who actually do the experiments on animals. In other words, it all comes down to money. The official position that an organization takes is usually dictated by the board and by the charter and so forth. And anytime you deal with charities that are interested in raising money from the public vis-a-vis medical research and to research specific human diseases, those people are probably being influenced by the very small portion of the scientific community that makes money from animal experiments. And so in part what you have here are the vested interest groups lobbying, as they always do, and in part what you have are just people without a scientific background who are being misled, who believe these scientists but have not looked critically at the issue.
Sure, yeah. Now, Dr. Greek, you're an anesthesiologist, so you would know something of the history of the discovery of anesthetic drugs, and I suppose that without anesthetics, as well as such concepts as sepsis and asepsis, surgery would be impossible. And so
that's correct, yes.
So the discovery of anesthetic agents and that sort of thing played a crucial role in the progress of medical knowledge, I suppose, and increased human longevity. If animal research played an important role here, it would be an argument for its utility. What is the case?
Well, in point of fact, most of the early anesthetic agents were discovered by accident. Back in the old days, in the 1800s, people had what were commonly referred to as ether parties, where they would go and inhale ether, and they would get all giddy for a few minutes, and then it was considered quite fun. And from that, people discovered nitrous oxide had a similar effect, and so on. So the way we really discovered general anesthesia was through serendipity and luck and just basically by accident. Interestingly, when those early general anesthetics were tested on animals, some of the animals died, some of the animals had very adverse effects, and so on and so forth. And so the field of anesthesiology was delayed for a while because of those aberrant results in animals. Now, today we can use various anesthetics in animals and humans, and anesthesiology as a specialty has certainly grown. But once again, this goes back to the main point that we make in our books, which is if you test 10 different species, you're likely to get at least 5 different results. And none of those are necessarily going to be the same result as you get when you test the drug in a human being. So testing on animals is fraught with danger, in part because it does not prevent bad drugs from coming onto the market, but it does prevent good drugs from coming onto the market, like these general anesthetics.
Yeah, like I understand that chloroform is extremely toxic to dogs, and yet...
If not used properly, it will kill dogs, and in the 1800s it did. One researcher anesthetized a bunch of dogs, and I think puppies also, and most of them died. And he concluded that general anesthesia was very dangerous for humans and so on and so forth, when in point of fact it was just a very typical example of one drug not being used appropriately and being used on a species other than what science had experience dealing with. There was a lot of experience giving chloroform to humans. There was not much experience giving chloroform to dogs. And that really sums it up in a nutshell. I mean, we are not dogs or cats or rats. We do have things in common with those creatures, of course. We have hearts that pump blood, and we have lungs that function similarly. But disease and drug response functions at a much, much different level. Now you're at the level of the genes and how genes are regulated and how they're expressed. And that's what makes different species different. And it's also what makes different individuals different.
Well, now, the doctor presumably treats his patient with care and respect and solicitude and, you know, altruistic feelings to heal him. But a researcher treats his animals just as experimental material to be manipulated according to his scientific whim, I think. And so the emotions or psyche of the animal is not even regarded. Now, that the kind of care given to the hospital patient is very unlike the kind of treatment received by a land animal in his barren cage. And so the two situations are entirely different, are they not? How can you conclude from one to the other?
Well, it's actually even a little worse than what you describe, because the mere fact that most of the animals that are used in laboratory research are really and truly, they're still in the wild state. They're not domesticated. Now, some of the dogs are domesticated, maybe some of the cats, but by and large, the animals that are used are feral or wild. And so when you put that animal in a cage, and when you surround that animal with other animals and other human beings, he's scared to death. And so you have vast differences in his heart rate, in his epinephrine levels, in how his adrenal glands function, and so on and so forth. So before you even get to how the animals are treated by the researcher himself, just this very environment is such that the results that you get are probably not going to even be applicable to the animal species with which you're dealing. And there's many examples of that, where they experimented on a rat and then looked at a different kind of rat, and the results did not translate. So, yes, using animals is fraught with problems. In the 1800s, we did learn a couple of things from animals. We learned, you know, what the heart does, what the lungs do, what the pancreas does. But those are very gross similarities on a very gross level. And science is way beyond the need to try and figure out what the lungs do. Today we're trying to cure cystic fibrosis, and that's not something that's going to come from animal studies.
Well, why do researchers consider that models are necessary then?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. Bottom line, the underlying reason for it all, though, is money. This is a multi-billion-dollar business. There's a lot of people who make a lot of money out of it. Of course, ego factors in. A lot of these scientists have very large egos, and they do not like it when people say that the research that they've dedicated their lives to has been essentially meaningless in terms of curing human disease. It's tradition. It's what we've always done. But again, it really boils down to money. And just as the charities that you mentioned at the top of the show, these charities want to raise money. And they want to give this money to people who are conducting research on animals. And the people who are doing research on animals want to support that charity. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, because once society becomes convinced of something, even if it's wrong, it's difficult to convince society otherwise. And that's what we try to do at Americans for Medical Advancement, is simply let society see both sides of the issue and let them choose for themselves.
So, now, I think what you've described is that animal research is cruel.
Yes, I think that would be a reasonable statement, sure.
Yeah. Okay, now the researchers say it's not cruel, or if it's cruel, then they'll say, well, it's necessary because, you know, the benefits to the human race far outweigh the cruelty to animals. So the point is that we have to, it has to be proven that animal experiments don't work in order for that argument to die. So
correct.
It all rests on that, doesn't it? So the researchers would like to have a moral argument about it because they'll say the premise is that it works, so we won't even discuss that. We'll discuss the moral pros and cons. But that cruelty cannot be allowed at all if animal research doesn't work. So that's the crucial question. Does it work or doesn't it?
That's exactly right. And again, science is a complicated subject. And when you're dealing with, the general public who is not scientifically educated, they may be educated in other areas, but if they're not scientifically educated, it's very easy for somebody in a white coat with a gray beard to stand up in front of an audience and convince them that experiments on animals are necessary. What we try to do is get the audience and the public in general to take a little more critical look at this. What results have come from animal experiments, good and bad? What really is the history of dealing with animals in research and so on and so forth? And I've been very impressed in all the lectures that I've done, the debates that I've done, when the lay member of society, the non-scientist of society, hears both sides of the argument, they usually see through the vested interest side and adopt our position. It's very difficult to reach 300 million people, or however many there are in the U.S. now, but we do try to lecture and do debates and write books and so on and so forth, because this is an ethical issue, not just for animals, but for human beings. There are people today who will die from cancer, stroke, heart disease, AIDS, and so forth. And as long as the research money is being directed toward experiments on animals, these people are going to continue to die. We are not going to get the cures that we so desperately need. So this is an ethical issue from two perspectives.
Mm-hmm. So the animal research really ensures the state of no cure. We're tossing out potential cures, and we're launching drugs onto the market that actually kill people and don't cure the disease.
The National Cancer Institute said, I think it was in 1996, that they believe that we have lost cures for human cancer because these drugs were ineffective in rats and mice. Now, that's a very sobering thought if you've lost someone, a family member, a friend, a loved one, to cancer, to think that there are cures that we have just tossed in the waste bin because they were ineffective in mice and rats.
Getting back to models, now other disciplines make models. We model the universe, we have mathematical models, we have models of... I'm not too familiar with scientific matters, but I know that other scientists model in their respective disciplines. So maybe the researchers feel they have to model too, but the only model perhaps then is the human being, not the animal. Would you agree with that?
I would not only agree with that, but I would actually go a step further. The only model for you is you. It's not me. It's not your mother. It's not your father. It's not your child. And the reason for that is that even though you may have an identical twin, someone who has the exact same genetic components that you have, the two of you may actually suffer from very different diseases and react very differently to the same drugs. And that is because of how the genes that you have are turned on and off, or what scientists say, how your genes are expressed. So what we usually find in medications is that some medications work really well for a small subset of the population, and they're really harmful to another small subset of the population, and there's a large group that they neither help nor harm. And so the key in the future will be what is called personalized medicine, and that is matching a drug to your particular genetic makeup and taking another drug and matching it to my genetic makeup for the same disease. So if you had high blood pressure, you might receive one drug that would be harmful to me but really helps you, and vice versa. So, yes, this idea of modeling humans with an entirely different species just ignores evolutionary biology, molecular biology. It really ignores all the advances in science that have been made over the last 50 years.
What would the ideal process of research look like then? If we don't use animals in experiments?
Well, probably the easiest one to describe would be drug testing. What you would want to do is design a drug on a computer. We now know what the receptors actually look like in three dimensions that the drug needs to fit. It's a lock and key mechanism. So you would design the drug on the computer. You would do various in vitro tests and computer tests to the drug, several hundred of these types of tests. And then you would give an incredibly small dose of the drug to a human being, and the human being would undergo what is called a PET scan and would also undergo other scans of that nature in order to see where the drug goes, how the drug is metabolized, and so on and so forth.
That would be a patient? Would that be a patient or a healthy volunteer?
No, it would probably just be a volunteer because the amounts of the drug would not be therapeutic. In other words, if you needed a drug, say, to be therapeutic for you, and the drug was 1 milligram, 1 milligram of the drug would be therapeutic, you would give 1/1,000,000th of a milligram. So there would be absolutely no way that that small of amount of drug could result in any permanent damage to the human being. It wouldn't result in any damage at all. And yet, even with that small of a dose, you can follow the drug through the human body by using these advances in technology. And this is already being done, by the way. It's not routine yet, but it is common for various drug companies to test their drugs. It's called microdosing. And I think you'll be seeing a lot more of it in the future. But that is how you would conduct drug testing up until your clinical trials. And when you found out what you needed to know about the drug from microdosing, you would then increase the dose slowly and give it to more humans and see how they reacted and so on and so forth. Now, the one thing that I left out of that equation is the genetics. When you're designing the drug, you would really design the drug for a specific genetic profile. And so when you tested the drug, you would test the drug on people only with that genetic profile. So the drug that you would take for your high blood pressure, I would never even have that drug tested on me, even if I were a volunteer, because our genetic profiles would be different. So this is personalized medicine, and this is the way you will see drug testing work in the future. Indeed, to a small degree, that's how it's working right now.
Researchers say we experiment on animals because it's unethical to experiment on human beings.
We experiment on human beings every day, and we don't do it with malicious intent, and we don't do it because, you know, we're mad scientists and so on. But every time you take a drug, you are in fact part of an experiment, because even if a million people have taken that drug prior to your taking it, those million people that took it before do not have your exact genetic makeup. And so even if a million people took the drug and did well with it, that drug might kill you. So to say that we don't experiment on people is somewhat disingenuous. No, we do not conduct experiments like Nazi Germany did, but every time you take a drug, even if you've had the drug before, your genetic expression may have changed slightly, and now you may have an adverse reaction to the drug that you did not have earlier. So there is risk involved in everything, but testing drugs on animals does not lower that risk for human beings. And in fact, I would make the argument that it actually increases the risk, because you get a false sense of security if the drug did not kill the guinea pig or the monkey or the dog or whoever it was tested on.
You're listening to Animal Voices, 102.7 FM, CFRO, and my guest is Dr. Greek. We'll open up the lines in a few minutes. Dr. Greek, so you're saying that careful human experimentation is what the future will look like, and also, what is the source of, what would be the source of new drugs? Herbal medicines have proven themselves for thousands of years. I think we can, I don't know what kind of studies you'd have to conduct to make it rational for the scientific community. It seems to me that thousands of years of practice and is proof enough.
Any new drug, whether it's an herbal drug, a traditional drug, or whatever, would go through really the same process. And that is, again, like I described, you would test the drug in human tissue and test tubes and so on, and then it would prove safe, and then you would give very small doses to human beings, and you would increase the dose, and then finally you would compare the drug with other drugs. For example, if it's a drug to treat arthritis, you would compare it with aspirin and other drugs. And if, let's say in the example of a herbal remedy, if more people got better from aspirin than got better from the herbal remedy, well, maybe the herbal remedy is not very good. But if more people got better using the herbal remedy than got better using aspirin, then there would certainly be a place for that drug in a physician's armamentarium. So it's really all about science and the scientific method, and it doesn't matter where the cure comes from. If the cure comes from Chinese medicine, I'm all for it. If it comes from Merck, well, that's fine, too. I want to see patients cured.
What the source of many pharmaceuticals is oil, is it not? Petroleum product of some sort, and synthesized from petroleum products.
Oh, Not that I know of. That's a new one on me. If that's the case, I have not heard that.
Well, I thought that the Rockefellers were sort of tied together by selling pharmaceuticals based on their other products of oil.
Well, that, yes, there is a connection there. The original pharmaceutical companies were actually chemical companies, which led to the oil companies that we know today. And the reason for that is the people who make pharmaceuticals and the people who refine and purify oil and oil-related products are all chemists. And back in the 1800s, there weren't 1,000 different chemical companies. There were just a few different chemical companies. So you would have chemists at the same company doing the oil work, doing work with plastics, doing work with pharmaceuticals and so on and so forth. So, yes, the history of pharmaceutical companies does lie in really the dye industry, which, again, the oil and petroleum industries also grew out of. But it's all chemistry. So to say that the drugs are refined from oil or that they come from oil, I don't think that would necessarily be correct. But to say that a lot of the same companies with the same shareholders and the same boards of directors are involved, yeah, sure, I think that would be reasonable.
My guest is Dr. Greek. He's an anesthesiologist and president of Americans for Medical Advancement. If you want to talk to Dr. Greek, call me at 604-684-7561. Now, can you say something about, we have a very big problem here in Vancouver of drug addiction, and spills out into the street, and it's got everybody scratching their head as to what to do. Do you have any solutions to... I know that researchers try to addict animals to various substances that human beings abuse, but that kind of modeling is, again, inappropriate, is it not?
And it's very inappropriate on several levels. Number one, we've been talking about how different species react differently to the same stimuli. But drug addiction is a social problem. There's a huge social and emotional element to drug addiction. And if you could addict rats to cocaine, and I'm sure some researchers have, and then found a drug that worked effectively to get them off the cocaine, that would only be addressing one small aspect of the problem that human beings face. Because human beings live in a very different world than rats live in when they're in cages. And it's the pressures associated with our normal life that cause some people to turn to drugs and so on and so forth. So any research that you conduct in an animal just totally ignores what I think is probably 90% of the problem, and I think psychologists would agree with me on that, which is the social interaction issue. And so, no, it's a waste of money, and unfortunately, we don't have an unlimited supply of research dollars. So every time a researcher gets $1 million to do cocaine research on monkeys, that's $1 million that is not going to go to help the actual addicts themselves. And that's $1 million that's not going to go to a human researcher who is looking for ways to solve the social problems that sometimes lead to drug addiction. So it's a lose-lose situation, no matter how you look at it.
We have a caller on line one, is it? Go ahead, caller.
Yes, hi. Thank you for your very insightful comments. A quick comment and then a question. I think it needs to be raised that we as human beings, to a large measure, are the architects of our own demise. And the fact that we live in a society where there's a proliferation of toxic chemicals, we live in this toxic stew, which we've brought upon ourselves through the petrochemical industry, industrial agriculture, toxic vaccines and medications, etc. And we see, of course, the corresponding rise in so many diseases that were vastly lower before. And in my own life, I've seen such drastic changes with myself, with my 91-year-old father who had cancer, who was cured naturally, with students I've taught, where just through common sense and changes in lifestyle and using herbs and vitamins, there's so much out there that we can already use to combat these so-called dreaded diseases, such as intravenous vitamin C, etc. And I think it's really criminal what's happening in the name of so-called medical advancement. What I wanted to ask the doctor was what he felt were some of the most effective ways in which the public can voice their anger and concerns regarding what is happening, this waste of money, not to mention the immorality of animal testing. And would you suggest that through these so-called animal, or should say medical charities, which I have many issues with, and what are some of your major accomplishments? Have there been certain universities now that have sworn off animal testing? If you could just give me a sense of some of the accomplishments as well as measures that you feel are effective in really trying to get this issue going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
If you could just repeat her final questions there at the end, because I could barely hear her with the several connections that we had to go through on the phone. So if you could just summarize those questions real quick, I'd appreciate it.
The rise in degenerative diseases and so on, and the chemical soup that we're living in these days, all generated.
Okay, let me address those two, because
yes.
I'll forget them.
Okay.
As I age, my short-term memory doesn't get any better. One of the problems with society at large from many perspectives is the fact that we're pouring chemicals into the environment at a rate unparalleled in human history.
Sorry about that.
And as I was saying earlier, it's how your genes are expressed that causes the disease. You may have three or four genes that cause cancer, but if those genes are never turned on or expressed, you will never get cancer. Well, the problem with dumping all these chemicals into our daily environment is that most of those chemicals do turn some of these genes on. And so, yes, there's a huge rise in diseases, and a lot of those increases in frequency are caused by the environment in which we live. I don't know how to change that. I think that human society as a whole has got to get very angry about it and force the powers that be to change the system, because as long as we are quiet and quiescent, money rules, and it especially rules in politics. So unless we can give the politicians reason to listen, and that means at least 50% of the population speaking out on this issue and actually not voting for the candidates who are currently in office, voting them out, and so on and so forth, that's a big job, and that's something that I don't think society is ready to do. And it's unfortunate, because people are dying every day of diseases that are entirely preventable.
Yes, and I think the second part of your question was what successes has your society or your association had in terms of persuading doctors to take on this movement?
We attend medical and scientific meetings, and we have a booth, and we talk to various physicians and scientists, veterinarians, and so forth. And we've had very good success at getting people to sign our statement. Our statement basically says that animal experimentation in order to search for cures for human disease and to test drugs is scientifically invalid, and it should be abandoned. And we've had very good success with that. We've had people who work at the National Institute of Health sign our statement. We've had people who are former animal-based researchers themselves sign our statement, and so on. The more of those meetings that we can attend, the better, because society is not going to listen to us until we have, several thousand signatures, people from all walks of life. Just like you were talking about at the top of the program, you have all of these charities who are being influenced by vested interest groups. We have to show society that there are thousands, and in fact tens of thousands, of physicians and scientists who agree with us, who think that the animal model is not useful. And I think then we will start to have influence and hopefully create change in society.
We have another caller. Go ahead, caller.
Good afternoon. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
The animal model is not valid for a very, very, very good biological reason. And this is something that is so obvious and yet is completely overlooked. The fact is that the human being is one of the few biological entities that does not produce vitamin C in its liver. All of the animals do, with the exception of guinea pigs and monkeys. Now, the vitamin C is the toxic neutralizer. It is the number one toxic neutralizer. In fact, it is so effective that if you have an overdose and given a huge injection of intravenous vitamin C, you can deal with that overdose immediately. You can deal with every viral problem with enough intravenous vitamin C. Now, the animals make vitamin C in their bodies. Therefore, if you're using an animal test to test a drug, that animal can neutralize the toxic effect of that drug easily, whereas a human being that is later on exposed to that drug simply can't.
Thanks for your call. Dr. Greek?
Well, yes, that is certainly a difference between animals and humans, and a very important difference. But it is just one of many. And the differences between species are almost endless. And so when you combine all of these differences together, what you're left with is the fact that they're one species, we're a different species. And even within our own species, you're different from me. Your genetic makeup differs from mine. So testing drugs on another human being is fraught with problems if you want to predict what that drug is going to do to you. But testing on a different species is just nonsense on stilts.
Genetically modified organisms have been released into the environment. And, you know, the only thing that we have to go by is animal tests, as far as I know. And the government has, on the basis of that, allowed these GMOs into the marketplace. And now the researchers who have blown the whistle have all been animal researchers, oddly enough, as far as I know. And they've said, no, it's toxic because of such and such. It does such and such to rats. Therefore, we must ban it. So it sows confusion everywhere when we don't have human data, we rely on animal data, and we throw things onto the market without regard for the consequences, it seems to me.
Oh, sure. I mean, that really gets back to what we were talking about earlier about how many different chemicals are being released into the environment today. And genetically modified organisms are really just, you know, a small group of chemicals in one package. And what those chemicals are going to do when you release them into the environment is a complete unknown, because we can't even predict what a drug is going to do in you. How can we predict what a chemical is going to do in all the various plants, to all the various fish in the water, to all the various wildlife, animals that live on the land, near the rivers, and so on and so forth. So releasing chemicals into the environment, be they, you know, petroleum-based chemicals or genetically modified organisms, is a very serious thing. And I do not think that society has paid enough attention to the possible consequences.
Thank you. We have a caller on line two. Hello, caller.
Hi there.
You're driving a truck or what?
Hello?
Are you driving a truck or what?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Anyhow, listen, I have a son who was vaccine damaged, the DPT inoculation. I had heard that there's a hormone product of a pig called secretin out there. Is it readily available on the medical market in the U.S. like it has a prescription?
Thanks for your question. We'll turn you off because the background noise is very bad. Were you able to hear that, Dr. Greek?
Yes, I did. Thank you. I'm not familiar with secretin from pigs. It may be available in the U.S. In my practice of medicine, it's not something that I use, and I don't think it's something that I would come across on a daily basis. So I honestly don't know the answer to your question. Sorry about that.
No problem. Another very contentious issue these days is stem cell research. Can you wade into that controversy for us?
Well, stem cell research is controversial really only from, I guess you would say, a religious or philosophical perspective. From a scientific perspective, even today, we are giving stem cells to human beings with certain forms of cancer, and these patients are doing better than they have done with traditional treatments. So stem cells do offer hope to many patients. Now, just recently, there was an item in the news about stem cells being grown without animal tissue. And this is very important because if stem cells are grown with animal tissue, then they're exposed to animal viruses. And if those stem cells are then given to human beings, then the human being is exposed to those animal viruses and that could be a very, very bad thing. Most of our great flu epidemics, including the one that we're supposedly having now, originally come from animals. The viruses start in animals, and then they're mutated, and they go to humans, and so on. So stem cell research, if the stem cells come from human beings and they're pure stem cells, scientifically speaking, that will be a very good thing. And it already is. There are, like I said, they are being used in certain forms of cancer and for various treatments, and they are effective.
And do they have to come from aborted fetuses, or what's the...
Well, to get a stem cell that can do anything, that pretty much has to come from an aborted fetus, at least originally. Now, you can get stem cells from umbilical cords, from newborn babies, and so on and so forth. Those stem cells are not quite as good as the stem cells that come from fetuses aborted in the very, very early stages. If we can ever get to the point where we can grow stem cells, again, without animal tissue and in great quantities, that will kind of make the ethical argument moot. But as of today, we're still having a little trouble growing these stem cell lines in large quantities and so on and so forth.
Yes, this is Animal Voices, 102.7 FM, CFRO. If you want to talk to Dr. Greek, call us at this number, 684-7561. Now, genetic research into disease. This is the future of medicine, and also, I think, much more going back to nature and naturopathic cures and so on. Do you agree with that, sir?
I'm not real sure what naturopathic cures are. Like I said, any cure that is actually a cure is a great thing. But before you can say that a chemical, wherever it came from, whether it came from a flower, a plant, wherever, was made in a lab, before you can say that this chemical is effective treatment for arthritis, heart disease, brain cancer, whatever, it has to be tested. And it has to be tested under very specific conditions. And one of the problems that the pharmaceutical companies have given us today is that when they test some of their drugs, they don't play by the rules. They test their drugs against other drugs that they know are inferior. So I don't care where the chemical comes from, and that's what all these things boil down to. They're all chemicals. The chemical has to be tested, and if it's effective and if it's safe, then great. And I personally, like I said, I don't care where it comes from. If some scientist in a white coat in a lab at Merck synthesizes it, that's fine. And if it's been used by the Chinese people for 10,000 years, that's fine too. But again, regardless of where it comes from, it has to be tested to make sure that that it is what it claims to be.
And you can do that through epidemiological means. If you don't have to separate the herb from into its component parts to know how which is the active ingredient and which you should then encapsulate and use as a drug. I mean, the whole herb is actually a drug. But we have another caller on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, actually, it's the same caller.
Oh.
There are two things that I would like to ask the doctor. One is, you made a comment on stem cells, and it is a fact that Dr. Becker was able to stimulate stem cells and cell repair 30, 40 years ago using electromagnetic frequencies. But again, that is an area that is has been literally drummed out of existence because it's such a competition to the idea of making drugs. And the other thing that I would like to mention is you said that drug addiction was primarily a sociological problem. Drug addiction is primarily a nutritional problem. And I would like to give you an example. There's a high school down in Wisconsin that had a horrendous drug problem. Drug problem, behavioral problem, crime problem, you name it. All they did was literally straighten out the nutrition throughout that school. They have no problem. They have no learning disability problems. They have no behavioral problems, they don't have any crime problems, and they don't have any drug problems. The fact that nutrition and not drug therapy is the base of health is something that has been fought by the AMA and the pharmaceutical industry for 100 years. It is an open war. And until we go back to realizing that we are what we eat and we think the, from what we eat, then we are not going to have any health, because the drug industry is not an answer to the health problem.
Thanks very much for your call.
Yes, that is a very good. I'm familiar with the very. There's been actually, I think, a couple high schools that have dramatically changed what they serve the students, and have seen a decrease in the misbehavior problems, drug-related problems, and so forth. And I'm a big believer in nutrition and in preventive medicine. I would just say, though, that I would actually classify that as a social problem, because what they were being served, what the high school students were being served prior to the change in diet, was determined by our society. It was a meat and processed food-based diet, which anyone who reads the scientific literature knows is not the best thing for you to eat. And so, yes, I agree with the caller. Nutrition is incredibly important, and so on. But I think the way that society determines what will be served in public schools and so forth, that's a societal issue, and it's a social issue. And that's what I mean when I say that drug addiction is in large part social and not necessarily physiological from the point of view that you're addicted to this particular drug. Yes, you are addicted, and you're psychologically dependent on the drug. But I think most psychologists do say that until you can solve some of the social problems that surround drug addiction, you're not going to solve drug addiction per se. Simply getting the addict off the drug, weaning him off the drug at a center and so forth, is not adequate.
Well, what should our diet look like? That's very controversial in itself. I mean, experiments on animals are being conducted all the time on this. Does butter harm you? Does is a high-fat diet this and that? And all sorts of confusions have crept in over the years, and now nobody knows how to eat, it seems to me, essentially.
Well, actually, there's a pretty easy rule to follow when you hear all of this conflicting evidence coming out of the media. The one thing you need to always ask yourself when some scientific breakthrough is being reported, or when scientists are discussing something, is who paid for the study? And what you find when a lot of the times when you hear that butter is good for you, you'll find that the people who paid for that study was the butter industry. Okay? And if you find that some study came out that saying eggs are good for you, you'll find that study was paid for by the egg industry. And so that's really not viable science. Viable science is when someone without any interest in the outcome of a study performs a study according to the scientific method, then those results have a high probability of being valid. But there's an old saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune, and scientists are just as corrupt as the rest of us. And if their livelihood depends on getting a certain result from a certain study, I can guarantee you that is the result that many of them are going to get. So I'm personally a vegetarian. I don't eat meat. I don't eat eggs. I don't eat cheese. Based on my knowledge of the scientific literature vis-a-vis nutrition, that is by far and away the best diet.
If you want to talk to Dr. Greek, you can call us at 684-7561, and we have a caller on the line. Yes, caller.
Hello, I'd like to slightly disagree with the nutrition lady and agree with the doctor. The incidence of alcoholism, for instance, in the Western world is quite endemic, but the country with the highest consumption of alcohol is Italy in the industrial West, and the country with the lowest rate of alcoholism in the industrial West is Italy, because alcohol is a social thing for them. You drink wine as a child, in fact, sometimes in Italian culture, because it's a family thing. Would the doctor like to talk about that, please? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, the caller makes a very good point. We don't live in a vacuum, and animals who, when they're used for research and testing, do live in a vacuum. And that's yet another reason that you can't trust the animal studies. No, anytime you talk about drugs, and I don't care if they're legal drugs or illegal drugs, drugs that were made by pharmaceutical companies or drugs that were made by people of ill repute, perhaps that would be the same thing in some cases, but regardless of where the chemical came from, there is a social component to the chemical, and especially mind-altering substances, marijuana, cocaine, and so forth. There are people who, if the circumstances are right, can take a very large dose of a mind-altering substance and not get at all drunk or high or anything else because of the society that they live in, because of how they react to these things, and so on and so forth. So, yes, you cannot ignore the social component of disease. You cannot ignore the social component of research into disease, and so on and so forth. And that is something that I think the medical research community has ignored to the detriment of society for many, many years. And the example of Italy is a very good one. It's a well-known example, and it's something that a lot of people just, you know, fall all over themselves trying to explain, when I think the explanation is very, very easy, and I think the caller hit the nail on the head.
Now, I have actually a quote that I wanted to quote right now, and that is from Robert Lawson Tate, who is a very famous doctor who originated many of surgery's modern techniques. I guess you know his name very well, doctor.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And he said, like every member of my profession, I was brought up in the belief that almost every important fact in physiology had been obtained by vivisection, animal experimentation, and that many of our most valued means of saving life and diminishing suffering had resulted from experiments on animals. I now know that nothing of the sort is true concerning the art of surgery, and not only do I not believe that vivisection has helped the surgeon one bit, but I know that it has often led him astray. So every member of the profession is taught this belief. Is that the case with you too, and how did you come to change?
Well, that's a very interesting story. Yes, I think his summation is correct. I think, and again, this gets back to money. When you're in college and when you're in graduate school, the people who are teaching you, a lot of the money that they earn comes from research on animals. And so they're very biased in their presentation of where great discoveries have come from, and so on and so forth. I, being a physician, came to the conclusion that animal experiments were not in the best interests of human society because of interactions I had with my wife, who was in veterinarian school at the time. She would come home and ask me questions about how we treated various diseases in humans, and I would give her the correct answer. But when she went to school the next day, invariably, my correct answer was incorrect for her patients. Of course, her patients were dogs and cats and ferrets and so forth, and my patients were human beings. And this happened more often than not. Occasionally, we would run into something that, you know, the same drug was used for the same purpose in various species. For example, some anesthetics are used in dogs and cats and humans and work well in all species. But for the most part, there was great dissimilarities, and the dissimilarities were not inconsequential. What killed a patient, one of my patients may be extremely beneficial to one of her patients, or vice versa. So this being confronted with reality is what originally led us to question whether experiments on animals were predictive for human beings. Now, if you want to learn about dogs, you can study dogs, and if you want to learn about cats, you should study cats. But if you want to learn about humans and human disease and how humans respond to drugs, you're going to have to study humans, because studying another species, again, it's just not going to be effective. So I was very hard to convert to this idea that animals are not good models for humans, because I had gone through, you know, the same medical training that most people go through, and if I had not been slapped in the face with reality every time my wife and I had a discussion about this, I would have never even questioned it, because it is so ingrained into you in college science classes and in medical school classes and so on and so forth. Now, that's not a good reflection on me. I should have asked questions that I did not ask. But human nature being what it is, most people do not, you know, question authority to the degree that perhaps we should.
Well, of course, in your books, you quote many, many people who have the same opinion as you and express it very well, and express it in the scientific journals and so on. But perhaps they're so such isolated phenomena that no one gets the drift of the entire scene.
Well, another thing that I learned when my wife and I were having these discussions is I would ask various people at the hospital where I worked, I would ask them if they did research on animals, and they would say, yes, they did. And I would ask them if they could apply those results to humans, and they would just laugh and say, no, they couldn't. But what was interesting was, for example, if I asked an internist that question, he would say that even though his results were not applicable, he was sure that the results from the surgery department were applicable. And so when I asked the surgeons if they could apply their results from animal studies to humans, they would say, no, they couldn't, but they thought that the psychiatrist could. And again, it really became kind of a round-robin thing where, in the final analysis, everybody thought that somebody else was benefiting from these studies. They knew that they weren't benefiting, and that their patients weren't benefiting, and they knew they were making money from the studies, and that the university was making money from the studies. But in terms of helping patients, everybody thought somebody else must be doing it. It's really an example of, you know, the emperor has no clothes.
Fascinating. Yes, we just have time for one more quick question. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have two questions, Doctor. Did you know that today's modern medicine and drugs, chemicals derived from Europe's IG Farben chemical plants and experimentation on human beings during the Nazi Holocaust? I don't think the 1996 movie conspiracy theory has ended at all. And that's my first question, if you would comment on that. And have you or could you list, since you're an anesthesiologist, the drugs that are used in anesthetic, and I believe there are 8 or 9. I understand there was one experimental drug they started using about 20 years ago. I think it started with a P. Perhaps you can help me out there. And also, but it is upsetting people's systems, causing permanent allergies and digestive problems leading to disease. And I'm citing many people I've spoke to who have had surgery, and their tummies are swelling. This happened to me, and I've never been right since. So it's happening to my mother prior. She's had operations prior to the use of that particular anesthetic drug. And I'm wondering what it is and what you as a doctor can do, anesthesiologist, to get it out of the drug mix that they use for anesthetic.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Well, let me address the second question first. There's probably at least drugs that are used by anesthesiologists for the purpose of decreasing pain or making pain absent, probably closer to 100, actually. So I'm not entirely familiar with the situation that the caller describes. Certainly drugs do harm people. Certainly, as I've been saying throughout the interview, some drugs will harm a subset of people and yet be very good for another subset of people. And that's why we need to test drugs not on animals, but on the patients who are intended to use the drugs. And I don't mean use them as guinea pigs. I mean, you know, we give them very small doses of the drugs and so on and so forth. And I think the take-home message from the second question is that we need to be doing more post-marketing drug surveillance. Again, I'm not familiar with the caller's predicament. I have not heard of this. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm just saying I haven't heard of it. But if such things do happen, and indeed they do, we need to know about it. And the way that people learn about this is through what is called post-marketing drug surveillance. When the drug goes to market, it should continue to be followed. That should be a law, and that law should be enforced. And right now, that is, in fact, not how things happen. And I'm sorry, but I forgot the first question.
Well, we don't have time anyway, Doctor. Thanks very much for your time. We're out of time, so.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much. My guest was Dr. Ray Greek, who is president of Americans for Medical Advancement, based in Los Angeles, and you can visit their website at curedisease.com. curedisease.com. So thanks very much for tuning in. Any idea what's on for next week, Carl? Can you say?
Yes. We'll have Helen on next week, and she's going to tell us about the relationship between animal rights and feminism. And Anthony Marr will be here, and he'll be talking.
The number you have called cannot be...
Steve will be here as well. Steve... we'll be talking about the seals, the seal hunt, and Anthony Marr's going on a big trip. So,
okay,
interesting
thanks.
Program for next week.
Yes, sir. All right, so our website is www.animalvoices.org. If you'd like to join Animal Voices, you can send us an email at loskin@telus.net or just go to our website and give us a call. This program streams live at www.coopradio.org. My name is John Pranger. Stay tuned for more great programming on CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver.